Today is August the 12th, 2020. It's time for the award-winning Personal Computer Show. I'm Hank Key and my colleague is Joe King. Do you know who has your personal data? Do you know how Facebook, Google, Amazon, and other big tech companies are using your personal data? Our website is pcradioshow.org. We are heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on prn.fm, streaming on the Internet. Podcasts of the program is available on prn.fm on the Internet, as well as pcradioshow.org. To listen to the live program on the telephone each Wednesday, it's 6 p.m. Eastern Time, and the number is 641-793-7091. You can leave me a message with your question or comment at hank@pcradioshow.org. Frances Allen was the first woman to win the Alan M. Turing Award, often called the Nobel Prize of Computing. She passed away last Tuesday at the age of 88. She was one of the few women in the computer industry in its early days. She helped create the fundamental ideas that allow practically anyone to build fast, efficient, and useful software for computers. She and her fellow researchers at IBM published the fundamental ideas in the development of the compiler, which is a software that translates source code written in a high-level language into a set of machine language instructions that can be understood by a digital computer's CPU. It is a software technology that takes in programs written by humans and turns them into something computers can understand, so programmers could build software in simple and intuitive ways and then have it run quickly and smoothly when deployed on real-world machines. In a field long dominated by men, Ms. Allen was a force for change in the 1970s and 1980s. Thanks largely to her own efforts, women accounted for half of the experimental compiler group inside of IBM. After more than three decades in the laptop business, Toshiba is packing it all in and saying goodbye. Toshiba will officially no longer be making PCs. It has taken a step back from making laptops. But this goes beyond that. It's a complete exit. In a press release, Toshiba issued a short and to-the-point statement announcing that it had transferred its remaining minority stake in its personal computer business to Sharp. Toshiba sold 80.1% of this business unit, which its new owners renamed Dynabook, to Sharp in 2018 and retaining 19.9% of shares. Sharp currently sells laptops under the Dynabook name. In its statement, Toshiba said that Sharp had exercised its right to buy the remaining shares of Dynabook held by Toshiba in late June, and it had completed procedures for the transfer. As a result of this transfer, Dynabook has become a wholly owned subsidiary of Sharp. And with that, Toshiba said goodbye to personal computers. Toshiba launched its first IBM-compatible laptop computer, the T1100, in 1985, and although there were other laptops on the market, the T1100 included a basic feature set that would set the standard for PCs for the next two decades. These features included internal rechargeable batteries, an LCD screen, a 3.5-inch floppy disk drive, and compatibility with the IBM PC. In the 1980s, PCs were popular, but very big. That was IBM compatible. The project faced many hurdles, from lack of financing to a floppy disk drive that was too small to run any software, but eventually pushed through. In 1985, Toshiba launched its T1100. It had 256 KB of RAM, a 640 by 200 pixel reflective LCD screen capable of displaying 25 lines of 80 characters, a 3.5-inch floppy disk drive that supported 640 KB and 720 KB disk. In terms of size, the T1100 was approximately 12.2 inches by 2.5 inches by 12 inches and weighed 9 pounds. At the time, it cost $1,999. According to the Register, Toshiba had the laptop market through the 1980s and much of the 2000s, and was often ranked among the top 5 PC manufacturers. What happened? Well, companies like Lenovo, Apple, HP, and Dell started building better laptops, and Toshiba's laptop business became weaker, and it sold the majority of the division to Sharp for $36 million in 2018. There's an old saying, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. Something right behind you is going to gain on you. So if you don't innovate, you have to be not afraid to cannibalize some existing business for new business with new innovations. Chromebooks were initially designed to be lightweight, web browsing laptops, but gradually started gaining more features, especially when it came to offline computing. However, unlike Mac OS or Linux, Chrome OS doesn't have the ability to locally run Windows apps, which can sometimes be essential, especially when it comes to corporate apps and other apps that are not available to Chrome. Back in June, Parallels and Google announced a partnership stating Chromebooks would soon be able to run Windows apps seamlessly. Windows Desktop for Chromebook Enterprise is set to be released this fall. Google considered adding dual boot functionality to Chromebooks, which would have allowed businesses to install Windows directly on the hardware. However, Google decided that doing so could compromise the security of the BIOS, firmware, and boot, and security is one of its primary selling points of Chrome OS. Virtualizing Windows inside Parallels Chrome OS allows Google to keep any security threats sandboxed from the system. Just like its popular Mac OS counterpart, the Chrome OS client will offer a virtualization solution that runs locally, allowing Windows applications to be executed on your Chromebook without needing to reboot or to have an active internet connection. The client will only be available for enterprise customers at least initially, and although Parallels software will be exclusive to Chromebook Enterprise users, at least initially, Google is working on a more consumer-focused offering, having given the report stating that Google is investing in running Windows and Chrome OS apps side by side. Initially, Parallels Desktop on Chrome OS will boot a full copy of Windows 10. That means you need to have a licensed copy of Windows 10 to go with this, so you'll be able to manage programs and files just like you would on a real Windows computer. Chrome OS will even redirect some Windows-specific file types to the virtual OS to make the process smoother. But running a full desktop inside Parallels is a clunky experience at the end of the day. Eventually, Google hopes to have Windows apps act like it was part of the Chrome OS interface, so you can just launch a Windows app without going to a different desktop. You will probably need a much more powerful Chromebook to run Windows initially, though. Many cheap Chromebooks come with entry-level Celeron CPUs and few measly gigs of RAM, and you're lucky to have 4 gigs of RAM initially. And that's fine for a few Chrome tabs, but not for virtualizing Windows because you're installing a full Windows 10 operating system and the Parallels on top of the Chrome operating system. Obviously, Google would have preferred people move away from Windows and live in a Chrome-based world only. But Windows has built in a huge software library that many people cannot do without. Google and Parallels will charge for this functionality, but they haven't been talking about what the pricing is yet. While Google may be planning on running Windows app on the Chromebook, Microsoft is not sitting idly by waiting for Google to eat their lunch. Microsoft has announced that they have integrated Android apps into Windows 10 with new Your Phone update. Android apps are getting tighter integration in Windows. Microsoft is now allowing Windows 10 users to run Windows apps side by side with Windows applications on a PC. It's part of a new feature in Your Phone available to Windows 10 testers today, and it builds upon the mirroring that Microsoft's Your Phone app already provides. You can now access a list of Android apps in Microsoft's Your Phone app and launch these mobile apps accordingly. These will run in a separate Windows outside of Your Phone app, mirrored from Your Phone. This new Android app support also allows Windows 10 users to multitask with other Windows apps with an Alt-Tab support, and you'll even be able to pin these Android apps to the Windows 10 taskbar or start menu. The ability to launch apps directly from Your Phone means you no longer have to search around on a mirror experience of Your Phone. You can simply pin your favorite Android apps to the taskbar and run them as if they are regular Windows apps. One big part of the new Your Phone experience is being able to run multiple Android apps side by side, something that Microsoft announced with Samsung Galaxy Note 20. Windows 10 users won't be able to access this particular feature until later this year on the Galaxy Note 20, and Microsoft says it's also working with Samsung to bring this to other devices. Not all Android apps will work seamlessly with this new Your Phone feature, though. Microsoft warns that some may block the ability to cast to other screens, producing a black screen instead. Some apps and games will also not respond to a keyboard or mouse, and others may play audio from Your Phone. If you're interested in trying out the new Your Phone apps feature, you'll need a Samsung device. Microsoft has a list of all supported Android devices, but it's literally only Samsung handsets right now. You also need to opt into Windows Insider's testing, and this will provide access to the Your Phone apps preview before it rolls out publicly. The initial version of a Parallels running Windows app on a Chrome notebook is only for the enterprise. It is not cost-effective. Until they release a version that does not require a full copy of Windows 10 and the ability to run apps as part of the Chrome OS, we'll just have to wait for that. The initial version of Windows 10 running Android apps is also limited to currently the Samsung Galaxy Note 20. We'll just have to wait until sometime next year to have greater capability to run different apps from one OS on another OS. It will be interesting times then. Does it matter who owns TikTok? There has been much to do about who buys out TikTok. TikTok, formerly known as Musical.ly, is a social media platform for creating, sharing, and discovering short music videos. Think karaoke for the digital age. The app Musical.ly was used by young people as an outlet to express themselves through singing, dancing, comedy, and lip-syncing. TikTok is owned by the Chinese technology giant ByteDance. TikTok lets users easily share short, funny clips, which can go viral really easily. But TikTok has been criticized by U.S. senators for censorship, privacy, and child safety. Because TikTok is owned by the Chinese company ByteDance, there are concerns that TikTok might censor content that doesn't appease China. The government says that the apps pose a threat to sovereignty and security of our country. Several reports about mobile apps on Android and iOS platforms stealing and then surreptitiously transmitting user data in an unauthorized manner to servers which have locations outside of India. The data is making its way from U.S. companies to servers in China constantly, regardless of who owns TikTok. Generally, when we talk about the unchecked data mining done by a given social network, we're talking about data mining that's done in the name of targeted ads. That's what's supposed to happen. We've seen a lot of this data repurposed, however, for federal surveillance. But as multiple lawsuits and U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo have shown us, the issue isn't as much with the data that's being hoarded as it is with where that data is being stored. In December, Chinese authorities officially enacted a piece of legislation that would give them a certain degree of unfettered access to data stored on servers based in the country or being transmitted through China-based networks. Despite TikTok's repeated insistence that it stores the data of its U.S. base on servers based locally and in Singapore, and despite the complete lack of available evidence that any U.S. user data is being stored in mainland China, critics have been pointing to the company's China-based parent company, ByteDance, as reason enough to be concerned. When an app beams your data from your phone into TikTok's or some advertiser's line of sight, there's a nearly infinite array of detours that is taken to get there at all. And those partnerships get even more tangled if your data happens to cross international borders somewhere along the way. Let's assume that officials in China can't wait to get their hands on any America's data from any app and aren't afraid to tap any data brokering companies within their borders in order to do so. And since this is what the picture is, whenever Mike Pompeo brings up the imminent threat of Chinese authorities, well, this is how it's probably done. You're probably familiar with the way some Chinese corporations have made a name for themselves in targeting consumers overseas with cheap crap that they don't really need but will almost definitely buy. And generally, where buyers go, marketers follow. While recent numbers are hard to come by, a 2017 report found that 50 ad tech organizations based in mainland China were cutting deals based around targeted consumers in the States. And because the U.S. ad targeting industry has been effectively swallowed by Facebook and Google, that means that Facebook and Google are pretty motivated to strike up the occasional multi-billion dollar deal with data brokers and ad aggregators based across the region. As it describes its business, AdTiger's primary role is connecting China-based marketers with the sort of platforms and apps we know and love here in the United States. For the most part, this doesn't mean working directly with, say, either Facebook or YouTube. Instead, it aggregates user and ad data from large players that are close with these respective companies. And since these details are from AdTiger's own documents that they sent to their investors, it's probably worthwhile assuming that the relationship actually exists. AdTiger lists key aggregators with names like OneSite and MeetSocial, and are also based in China, which means that hypothetically, any data that they're getting into their hands can also be beamed back to these national authorities, legally speaking, of course. AdTiger's IPO specifically names MeetSocial as its go-to for siphoning Facebook data, OneSite for Twitter data, and VidLows for data from Google properties like YouTube or Google Search. Like these players, Snap also has a long-running local partnership with the China-based search giant Baidu. In this case, that AdTiger uses to tap into millions of Snapchatters in the United States. Facebook's own site for its China-based marketers lists AdTiger as a primary partner. On top of that, AdTiger also lists off a direct line to Google's ad-serving systems, along with more direct lines into Yahoo's and TikTok's own networks. The layer of intermediary partners means that even if TikTok or Google and any other major tech player swears up and down that it keeps any user data in the United States, that point is mostly moot. As soon as a foreign intermediary gets its hand on the data, any liability, or really any control, is largely out of a U.S.-based company's hands. Even if you try to wedge a company like Microsoft in there, the point is still moot, because it has a massive footprint in Shanghai that helps local brands use Bing to target high-end consumers in America and abroad. So, the net-net of all this means that when you open your phone to, say, Facebook or Twitter or YouTube, you see an ad that AdFinger or any of its intermediaries help plop onto your screen. This is pretty much the basic path your data might go down, only multiplied by about 50 or 100 or by however many of these companies there are, and there are many. The wonderful world of digital advertising is built on black boxes, inside of black boxes. This means that there's a good chunk of people who work at these companies who likely can't tell you exactly where your name, your phone number, and your precise location or other personal data might actually end up. But if you're wondering what kind of data this digital economy is getting their hands on, the only vague clue that AdTiger offers is that it is siphoned from these partners' respective APIs, which, as they put it, gives them a nearly infinite funnel of real-time data about the American audience that might have glossed over or clicked on a given ad. TikTok isn't the only problem here. Banning TikTok or shifting it under American ownership is the digital data equivalent of selling a burning skyscraper to a new owner and expecting that to put out the fire. There was a news report from the Wall Street Journal. A new report exposes how a federal contractor secretly puts government tracking software into hundreds of mobile apps. The data gleaned from this tracking is then sold back to the U.S. government for undisclosed purposes. According to the report, at least one federal contractor puts government tracking software in over 500 mobile applications. The contractor, a Virginia-based company called Anomaly 6 LLC, pays mobile developers to include its in-house tracking code within their apps. The trackers then collect anomalized data from our phones, and Anomaly 6 aggregates that data and sells it to the U.S. government. The whole thing sounds crazy, but it's happening, and what's more, it's totally legal. The report from the Wall Street Journal makes it clear that tracking software from Anomaly 6 appears in over 500 mobile applications. Anomaly 6 would not disclose the apps with which it has partnerships. The Wall Street Journal was unable to get any information through other means. One would assume that you could dive into the terms of service agreements of popular apps and find references to Anomaly 6. That would be a waste of time, though, because app developers don't need to disclose Anomaly 6 trackers to users. Therefore, you could have one or even dozens of apps with Anomaly 6 government tracking code, and you would never know about it, and you wouldn't have any idea that it was done. The tracking code used by the federal contractor does not need to be disclosed to the user by the app on which it is running. The data Anomaly 6 collects is anonymized. Each smartphone is attached to an alphanumeric identifier that isn't linked to the name of the phone's owner. Of course, there are plenty of ways one could use anonymous data such as these to figure out who owns a device. For example, the device would be idle at night while the owner sleeps, and the device's location at that time, like the owner's home. Well, if you do that, you can track who the owner is. Once you have that info, it isn't too difficult at all to conclude other useful habits, such as where you work and what you use to commute and where you go to eat and a whole lot of other data. Since Anomaly 6 doesn't disclose its government tracking software, there's no way to opt out. You're being tracked and your smartphone habits are being sold to the government, and there's nothing you can do about it. Since the idea of tracking location data via smartphone is still relatively new, laws and regulations related to the practice are way behind the curve. Since the data Anomaly 6 collects is technically anonymous, and since it isn't selling the data for commercial purposes, that is to say advertising and marketing, it's fine to do this within the eyes of the law. The big question, though, is what the government is doing with this data. Is it just keeping tabs on its citizens? Does it use it for law enforcement purposes? Is it using it as a counter-terrorism tactic? There's a whole batch of questions that need to be answered, and Anomaly 6 had no intention of answering them. According to the company, the business it conducts is considered confidential, although technically not classified. So it can't elaborate on its business partners without their strict permission. And obviously, that permission isn't likely easy to get. Perhaps one way of getting more from what the company does is we pass laws that says if you collect data of any form on an individual and whatever technical means you use it, you have to get permission to do it from the user. Presenting Benjamin Rockwell with his IT Pro Series. Problems, list or one at a time.
All right, it's time to talk business. This is Benjamin Rockwell. I'm going to talk about business and IT. I have 30 years of experience doing this, so you might imagine I've seen quite a lot. So let's dive in. And this week's topic, I want to talk about the idea of these issues that we have these ideas in our mind of how we should address tech support, how we should contact tech support, how we should do this, that, or the other thing. Do we focus on one support issue at a time, or do we put together lists, or what? How is the person on the other end going to handle this? So I'm going to tell you, this is my personal approach. And I say this having been on the other side, where I have been the person doing the supporting for so many years too. And I will tell you that I would rather you come to me and you have a list, a detailed list. And I will ask you questions. If you've got five things that you need handled, let's address all of them. I will tell you right now, actually, one of the things I do when I finish up with somebody, and I try to do this as genuinely as I can. We've heard this before. You're on the phone to your cell carrier. And is there anything else AT&T can help you with today, sir? It can be Verizon, it can be T-Mobile, it can be whoever it is. It doesn't matter. The whole idea here is it's that really fake line of how else can we help you today? And I try to make this genuine. Look, hey, while I'm here, what else can I help you with? While I'm on the phone with you, is there anything else that you were struggling with? I like this. I like to tackle multiple things at once. As a matter of fact, one of the things I do in my daily job, I do a lot of different reviews and approvals, and I go through a lot of different things, and I check back with everybody. Hey, was there anything else? You've got my attention. Hey, let's tackle anything else you might have going on. And this is across the board. I like that approach. Now, one of the things I want to make sure that you do, whenever you have an issue, is that it needs to be separated from the other issues in some fashion in the technical world. What do I mean by this? Well, most of the time when you're calling for technical support, you have a ticketing system. And there are a ton of different ticketing systems. I'm not going to rattle off all of the different names out there for you, because most of you would go, I don't need to know what ticketing system you use. I just need to know that there is a ticket. So there is a ticket that is created, and we're going to go with simple numbers. that ticket might be L0001. And that's the first ticket that you create. And you then, with your second issue, you want a separate ticket created, L0002. And your third, L0003, L0004, L0005, however many issues you have, you want those as separate issues. I worked with a ticketing system when I was the only guy in the building, in the company that was dealing with technology. It was a small company. It was about 150 employees. Most of them had access to the computers. And yes, I kept up with all of them. But I did so by utilizing a ticketing system. And anybody could send in a request into the ticketing system. They could get updates anytime I updated their ticket, anytime I looked at something in regards to their ticket. And I usually had a number of tickets on hand. That's because as much as you try to keep up with everybody, there's always tickets that, okay, we need to order hardware. We need to do research on this. We need to chase after that. We need to do this. We need to do that. And there's also the prioritizing. I will tell you, many companies do this. We're juggling all of the different tickets that are coming at us. We have to prioritize. If the CEO's computer is down, he gets top priority. It's going to be a lot more priority over that versus somebody has a printer which occasionally jams, like once a week. All right. So, you know, you balance these things out. So, again, we put together these things. But it allows us, if I fix problem 0002 or L0002, I can still have those other four tickets open. I can still address those separately. I can prioritize those, and I can say, Johnny, which one's most important to you? Oh, L0004? Great. Let's focus on that today. Let's get that out of the way. I want to encourage you to also share this information anytime you're dealing with tech support to prioritize. I have five issues. I'm going to tell you the most important issue, but I've got these other four issues. We can deal with these whenever you want. And please, please, I beg of you, have some leeway. Give everybody a chance. Say, look, this one needs to be tackled today. This is important because we're going to lose a gazillion dollars if we don't do it. These other four, look, you can get to them in a week, a month, 2 months. Just help me get this one out of the way, and then we'll tackle the others whenever you have time, Benjamin. And that's how I would prefer to work, and I hope you would work with people the same way. This is Benjamin Rockwell. Back to you, Hank.
Thank you, Benjamin. The Internet of Things, also sometimes referred to as the Internet of Everything, consists of all the web-enabled devices that collect, send, and act on data they acquired from their surrounding environments using embedded sensors, processors, and communication hardware. The Internet of Things is the concept of connecting any device to the Internet and to other connected devices. The Internet of Things is a giant network of connected things and people, all of which collect and share data about the way they are used and about the environment around them. The expansion of the Internet of Things will compound security and privacy risks to individuals. Privacy researchers warn that the media access control, that's the MAC address, that identify connected devices pose a serious privacy risk to individuals, allowing would-be attackers or businesses to collect a wealth of data about an individual's movements, activities, and preferences. A basic feature of the Internet of Things Foundation is the use of the MAC address to ensure that you have a unique ID. If you have two devices trying to use the same ID, that may cause a conflict to the connection. What is a MAC address? A MAC access control address is a unique identifier assigned to a network interface controller, otherwise called NIC card, for use as a network address in communications within a network segment. This use is most common in most IEEE 802 networking technologies, including Ethernet, Wi-Fi, and Bluetooth. Within the Open Systems Interconnection, or OSI network model, MAC addresses are used in the Medium Access Control Protocol sublayer of the data link layer. MAC addresses are primarily assigned by device manufacturers and therefore often referred to as burn-in addresses or as an Ethernet, hardware address, and physical address. Each address can be stored in hardware, such as the card's read-only memory, or by a firmware mechanism. Network nodes with multiple network interfaces, such as routers and multi-layer switches, must have a unique MAC address for each network interface controller. Are media access control addresses really unique? What is the probability of having two identical MAC addresses within one network? I have been adding to the home network with smart devices, home assistants, and remote peripherals. The network has expanded with multiple SSIDs, and I have a wireless mesh system alongside with power line and home plug adapters. So when the IEEE says the probability of having two identical MAC addresses within one network is zero, they are not aware of Murphy's Law. Murphy's Law is an adage that is typically stated as, anything that can go wrong will go wrong. The IEEE manages MAC addresses. The hardware identification addresses that the IEEE distributes are unique. That makes the probability of matching MAC addresses zero. On the other hand, some hardware MAC addresses are programmable, which makes them spoofable. This means that it is possible for two machines in the same network to have the same MAC address. If two devices have the same MAC address, which occurs more often than network administrators would like, neither computer can communicate properly. On an Ethernet LAN, this would cause a high number of collisions. What happens when there are duplicate MAC addresses? Manufacturers reuse MAC addresses and they ship cards with duplicate addresses to different parts of the United States or the world so that there's only a very small chance two computers with network cards with the same MAC address would end up on the same network. I didn't know that. I thought MAC addresses were unique on every communication device. Devices are uniquely identified by their MAC addresses. This is not an absolute truth, and in the past, vendors have intentionally or by mistake assigned the same MAC address to multiple devices. It is possible to change the MAC address presented by most hardware to the operating system, an action often referred to as MAC spoofing. MAC spoofing is a technique for changing a factory-assigned media access control address or MAC address of a network interface on a network device. The MAC address is hard-coded on a network interface controller and cannot be changed. However, there are tools which can make an operating system believe that the NIC has the MAC address of a user's choosing. Manufacturers reuse MAC addresses and they ship cards with duplicate addresses to different parts of the United States or the world so that there's only a very small chance that two computers with network cards with the same MAC address would end up on the same network. In order for network devices to be able to communicate, the MAC address it is using must be unique. No other device on that local network subnet can use that MAC address. If two devices have the same MAC address, neither computer can communicate properly. On an Ethernet LAN, this will cause a high number of collisions. Duplicate MAC addresses on the same LAN are a problem. Duplicate MAC addresses separated by one or more routers is not a problem, since the two devices won't see each other and will use the router to communicate. And here I thought MAC addresses were unique. Presenting All Hands on Tech with Marty Winston, Surge and Rescue.
Have you ever been hit by lightning? Would you ever want to be? And if they had feelings, how do you think your computer or your big screen TV would feel about that? Pretty burnt up? Know what? They don't have to get hit by lightning to get hit by lightning. That's not a self-contradiction. It's part of the chain of consequence that you'll want to understand. It happened to me a few years ago. Lightning hit a tree 2 houses over. Our house had surge protectors all over the place. They probably made a little difference for a few things, but by and large, they were nearly worthless. In a flash, 19 pieces of equipment all fried. There's a lesson in how that happened. It wasn't as much of a front door entry as you might assume. That house had analog phone lines and cable TV and fiber internet connections all coming from underground. Those each had some form of surge protection at the wall. Does that sound safe? Lightning may not have a heart, but it does have a pulse, an incredibly strong one, an EMP, the acronym for electromagnetic pulse, an EMP that some see as being weapon class. There's an unexpected path to follow, so let's connect the dots. The signals that come through to the modems and cable boxes suddenly get jolted by that huge EMP. That pulse gets into those interface boxes and rides through to their power cords, then down the power cords to the outlets and across the power cabling in the house to things plugged into other outlets. Surge protectors tried taking those bullets, but they were soon overwhelmed, and a depleted surge protector offers no protection at all. One more time on that statement because it's important again in a couple of minutes. A depleted surge protector offers no protection at all. Those pulses are like lightning, very abrupt. You might say lightning quick. And as many of you know, protective things like fuses and circuit breakers are designed to respond, well, let's not say slowly, let's say less than instantly. They're not lightning fast. Stuff can fry and they may not trip or blow. All of this is about understanding that some of the nasty stuff that gets to the power line may not start at the power line. Some of it does, like when storms or vehicle collisions down wires, or when major equipment in shops that could be a mile away turn on and that initial kick hits the wires, comes to you. There's a lot of stuff coming down the power line that's less than smooth and pretty. Spikes can be pretty bad, but for now, consider anything that's above normal as a surge, S-U-R-G-E, surge. You know the bad stuff that convinced you to buy surge protectors, but few people understand that surge protectors don't work forever. After 5 years, most are totally ineffective. Many times, that happens in just 2 to 3 years. That's because most of the surge protection that you can buy off the shelf depends on a component called an MOV. That stands for metal oxide varistor. Don't write that down. It won't be on the quiz. When an MOV sees too high a voltage, it converts the additional power into heat by changing its resistance. And that's how it stops that extra power from getting through. But every time it does that, the heat eats away at the oxide in the MOV. The more often an MOV sees surges, and the bigger the surges it sees, the more quickly the oxide gets eaten away. Even normal power lines carry endless small surge events, and those too get the oxide in MOVs eaten away. More like sandpaper than like a chisel, but over time, all of that oxide is gone, kaput. And at that point, the MOV is doing exactly nothing to protect you. It may only take one huge surge or spike to kill it in less than a second. Sometimes it's just a constant wearing away over time. And that means after 2 or 3 years, functionally, its ability to protect is just a memory. Don't count on MOVs. And a failed MOV, electrically, looks like no connection at all. Does your surge protector have a little light to tell you that the MOV is still okay? Well, the truth is it has no way of knowing. It's a false positive. Ignore it. MOVs are a cheap and easy way to add surge protection to a product and the only way most people will ever encounter, but there are better ways. While serious surge protection designs may involve beefier, more substantial, more industrial-grade versions of MOVs, those are mostly a last line of defense. Passive components like choke coils and capacitors have a role to play. Remember, a power line at 50 hertz or 60 hertz is an AC signal. And like a radio, designers can make a tuner, in tech terms, an LC tank, to only let that 50 hertz or 60 hertz signal through and block or at least diminish anything that isn't part of that pure sine wave signal. Beyond that, active components can get triggered by any too high voltage on the line to instantly shunt off some of that energy. Getting that level of protection costs more than a few dollars, more like a few $100 plus the cost of an electrician. But it installs just once at the breaker box. I'm sorry, that's old school. At the load distribution center to provide whole house protection. Nothing to add to your existing outlets. No need to add allegedly surge-protected power strips. Meanwhile, outdoors, you also need to keep one eye on the weather. Weather and people are two of the main reasons that some of the worst surges happen. It isn't just lightning. When ice or snow weighs down tree limbs and they short across wires, pow, there's always a surge and sometimes an outage. Add enough wind and trees can fall into the wires and snap utility poles. Even where it's treeless, water or snow or ice can make for slippery roadways that mean accidents where the thing that's getting hit turns out to be a utility pole. Major wildfire events also wreak havoc. Right now, we're getting into a time of year when any and all of this may be on the near horizon, and if you don't expect the unexpected, well, you may want to adjust your expectations. Okay, this started with lightning, and that brings up two other things that merit some attention. The first is lightning protection for the house. Does yours have a lightning rod? That's rare these days. Should it? In an ideal world, yes, but most of what people know about lightning rods is wrong. How many do you need? Where do you place them? Do you connect them with each other? Do you ground them all at once or separately? Do you interconnect your grounds? For now, even if lightning protection is a maybe someday wish list item, it wouldn't hurt to get grounded in grounding. Ultimately, every house should have exactly one ground. Ideally, that's a conductive ground rod as long as you can get and driven as deeply into the ground as you can get it to go. It connects to every ground reference point, especially the one at the load distribution center, but also the ones where phones or cable TV or whatever other services come into the house. Inside our load distribution panel, the breaker box, every white neutral wire from every power cable gets connected to ground. Electricians call that bonded to ground. And every cable has a ground lead that's also connected to ground. Good grounding helps dissipate charge buildup that could turn into a surge or spike event, and overall, it's just plain safer. There is a whole house surge protector at the box. There are others where signals enter. Coaxial surge protectors at the incoming cable TV and internet connections. And RJ45 surge protection on every Ethernet connection that goes to anything outdoors, like surveillance cameras. One more important element in all of this is not the least bit electrical or electronic. It's the final contingency if all these other preventive measures fail to foil the frying. Can you guess? It's insurance. Your homeowner's or renter's insurance is a critical fallback for extreme events. If your stuff gets devastated by surges, good insurance may be your best chance for a rescue. Next time, well, you'll be glad you weren't around to share this adventure, because it killed any chance of hot water here for 5 days. That's 5 days without a shower. And the resulting, to be kind, aroma? Well, it made personal distancing a freely volunteered result. It was one of the rarest of failures, a hot water tank that began erupting water out of its top vent pipe collar. The full story is almost sure to get you thinking about the choices at your house in a segment we call Getting Out of and Back Into Hot Water. It was scarier than a fat plumber in skinny pants.
Thank you, Marty. Public service announcements. Computer Club meetings in the New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut tri-state region. Some of the computer clubs have begun to schedule their general monthly meetings through teleconferencing. For update information, visit the website of the computer club. And if you're interested in the subject itself, RSVP so you can get a meeting ID. The New York Amateur Computer Club meeting will have a presentation on RetroPie video game system emulator on the Raspberry Pi. Thursday, August the 13th. Meeting time is 7 p.m. via Zoom virtual meeting online. The website is nyacc.org to RSVP for meeting ID. The Westchester PC Users Group will have a presentation on pandemics then and now. August the 13th, meeting time is 7 p.m. via Zoom video conference. Their website is wpcug.org to RSVP for a meeting ID. The Brookdale Users Group will have a presentation August 27th. Meeting time is 6:45 p.m. and the topic of presentation is computer gaming for everyone, and it'll be via Zoom virtual meeting. RSVP at bcug.com for meeting ID. The Amateur Computer Group of New Jersey meets Friday, September the 11th, and their meeting time is 8 p.m. via Amazon Chime. For more information on how to get onto Amazon, RSVP to acgnj.org for more information on how you can participate via Amazon Chime. Our website is pcradioshow.org. We are heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on PRN.fm, streaming on the Internet. Podcasts of the programs available on PRN.fm on the Internet. If you have any questions for us, just send me an email addressed to hank@pcradioshow.org. In the meantime, stay in touch. And remember to do your regular backups on your computer. I'm Hank Key, and on behalf of Joe King, Michael Horowitz, Marty Winston, and Benjamin Rockwell, we thank you for your support. Stay safe and healthy until we meet again, same time, same station next week.